Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell.
Hey, I met you. You are not cool.
With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick.
I am the smart. S-M-R-T. I mean S-M-A-R-T.
And Josh Adams.
You goddamn communist heathen, you had best sound off that you love the Virgin Mary, or I'm going to stomp your guts out. Now, you do love the Virgin Mary, don't you?
Visit us at IHateCritics.net, IHateCritics.com, EveryonesCriticPodcast.com. We're on Facebook. Our Twitter and Instagram handles are CriticsPod. There you can read reviews that Sean wrote, blog posts Josh and I write, watch the trailers, top fives, random news that we find interesting, and just and interact overall. And then iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, that's where you can listen to the show, Spotify. No matter where you listen to us, so please go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts and subscribe to the show, rate and review the show. We will read your review on the air. It'd be nice to do that again if anybody feels like it. And Patreon, ihatecritics.net/Patreon is the best way to help support the podcast. You get a credit on the show. We haven't made merch in a while, but if we when we make it again, we'll send more out to our subscribers and bonus episodes and all that. So ihatecritics.net/Patreon. Let's move on to our... let's start with the news, I guess. We'll start with Margot Kidder. We don't always talk about people who pass, but she literally just did right before we recorded or earlier in the day, so it's just fresh on the mind. Fans?
I mean, obviously, you know, somebody on Twitter put it quite well. I thought when they think of Superman, you know, the comic book image of Superman kind of come to mind. But when you think of Lois Lane, Margot Kidder comes to mind. I thought that was a pretty great statement about the impact she made in that role, and a true statement. I had the same reaction. Honestly, when I think of Lois Lane, the first thing I do think of is Margot Kidder. That's the image I have in my head when it comes to Lois Lane, and that is that's quite a remarkable legacy.
It's true, and on top of that, with Amy Adams playing the role in the recent films that she's been in, I think she plays it well, but I find myself watching her and comparing her to Margot Kidder's performance, mainly because that's what's been Lois Lane to me. Even the animated series that I watched for such a long time, Dana Delaney voiced Lois Lane, and there's a certain wry sarcasticness that only works because Margot Kidder played her, and Amy Adams is just doing something very different. But what I got the essence of the character was definitely something that Margot did, not necessarily better, but embodied the character a little bit more. So in terms of her other work, we watched Black Christmas on this podcast, and we know that Cousin Jeff is a big fan of the film. I wasn't so much a big fan of the film, but I still understand why it's popular and whatnot. And I'm sad to see her go. I did not see particularly what caused her death, but I don't know if I even really want to know, to be honest. But I'll think of those two now both being like rest in peace now that I watch those films, which I will do, of course, over and over again long as I'm around.
She was telling a story to somebody at a party once about how she'd moved to Montana. This was after she'd retired, and she'd said about she was talking about her breakdown that made kind of headlines a few years ago, that if she ever goes missing again, just to tell people that she'd been eaten by wolves. And that's the death she wanted, was to be eaten by wolves in Montana.
Strong possibility of that actually happening.
she was a fascinating lady. She was also in, you know, the Amityville Horror as well.
Yeah, which not a good. I mean, and she's kind of a horror queen in general. I mean, she's been in a handful of popular horror movies, and that one's definitely. I don't know if the movie itself is to the test of time, but the. Because of that movie, the what's their names are never going.
The Warrens.
Away. The Warrens. but I don't know. Rest in peace, Margot Kidder. I wrote Margot Robbie too many times today in my notes over and over again, and it's there's only two Margots that I know. And then Bill and Ted 3.
Yeah, why are they doing that?
I've been asking for it for years. I guess it'll be fun to see a 50-year-old Keanu Reeves playing whichever one he was. George Carlin's no longer around, so I don't... I mean, you could make it if you know... There's a way to make it fun, I guess. Middle-aged guys.
And their children. The story that I read is that, you know, their children will be involved in time travel and recruiting historical figures again. And to be honest, we don't really have this type of movie around anymore. You know going in that it's completely goofy. Please set aside your expectations of it even feeling like nostalgia good for you. It's just supposed to be funny, silly, fun. I can see that happening. And in terms of who would replace George Carlin, I was thinking Kevin Smith, to be honest. Considering how well he told stories of George Carlin when we saw him last month and his proximity to the man, I see no reason why Kevin Smith couldn't fill that role as his surrogate. I'm totally down with that. Why wouldn't that? Carlin was for Bill and Ted. They may have another representative for their children. Kevin Smith would fit that bill well, I think.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I worry about is, you know, like you said, goofy and fun. Keep that in mind when you're making it. Don't you? You know, we're all expecting that. Don't go and make Rambo 4.
Sure. We do have the original writers on board, too, and adequate director Dean Pariseau is supposed to be in charge of the project. He made Galaxy Quest. That lends a certain air of... gosh, it's going to be at least this good, you know?
And I do like the idea of, like, middle-aged guys in a failed rock band who never did write that song they keep talking about.
Yes.
But again, we'll see what happens. I'll definitely go see it.
Oh, yeah.
And it'll be a reason to bring that show to the show.
Theoretically, would it sustain you to know that, like, 1,000 years in the future, something you did was that important, but then in your life you were a complete failure?
That would sustain me in a second, but I'm easy.
I don't know. I've never really thought about it, and I still don't.
It's because you're not a failure in life. Yeah, you don't have to think about that. I think about it all the time.
I don't care. Even if I was a failure, and I'm not saying I'm not, I think it's all relative. You kind of define what's a failure and what's not. So I don't know. I mean, for some people, not failing is having a three-way at some point in your life. And other people, it's, you know, we all have different goals.
That's a really good point.
That's a strangely specific example.
That's me totally deflecting the question.
You did say that your wife doesn't listen to the show.
I'm a failure. So far. Not really.
Wait a minute, what?
I'm just kidding. Hey, we got a lot of show to kill because we don't have much for movies this week. So,
oh man.
Anyway, we got
good.
We got two trailers this week. We'll start with Predator. It was a continuation of the greatest action movie of all time.
That's right. Very good, Bob. Thanks.
Speaking of, that's the chopper movie, right? Or Get to the Chopper. That's
yes.
From that movie. My son yelled that yesterday, and I'm like, where the hell did you hear that?
You know, that before I ever showed my son any Arnold Schwarzenegger
YouTube
film, which, what's that?
YouTube, Lego, something like that.
No, I would make the voice to him because I had the Terminator 2 poster up. You say, who's that? I'm like, well, he can't see that movie. But he says lines like this. He's kind of a silly guy. And then he saw Batman and Robin at one point. Okay, fine. It's his worst example, you know. And then you go see Kindergarten Cop like this past March. And there's only like a 5-6 minute set of scenes there that is even memorable at all. And the rest of the movie is actually kind of dark. Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. You lack discipline. And all that good stuff is all pretty much right in a row. So I can understand why. I think kids understand that their parents are stupid. And that, you know, yeah, my dad makes fun of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and so then they do the voice too. Don't worry, I don't think he's checking out T2 behind your back.
Oh, no, I don't think he's... And I know he didn't watch Predator with me when we watched it, but... But he watches way too much YouTube, and that's probably where he heard it.
Some Minecraft person, yeah.
Right. It totally caught me off guard, though. And I was like, we're talking about that on the podcast this week.
That's a weird thing about the way that kind of culture can penetrate. People will be repeating things for years, and they have no idea where it came from because somebody said it in a Let's Play.
And then eventually they'll do a podcast and be like, holy shit, that's from this movie. Which happens to us on occasion here.
Yes, it does.
Trailer, thoughts?
The trailer, speaking of Arnold and the original film, there was a part written for him, and he decided that he didn't have a big enough role in the film. He didn't want to do it. So Shane Black tried to placate Arnold, and he wasn't placated enough. I felt this was a strong enough teaser trailer. I mean, we're going to get a better full trailer later on. It doesn't give away a whole lot of the Predator himself. It just gives you something of a setting. The acting strength here isn't real strong, per se, unless you're a huge fan of TV-based actors, mostly. I have nothing but faith in Shane Black, though, that it's going to be an incredibly enjoyable film. Nothing landmark by any means. This is the fourth or technically like sixth film in a series that's not the best science fiction film, but best action, you know, film derivative. And I have my sights set correctly, I think. And this trailer does nothing to dissuade me.
I have yet to dislike anything, I think, that Shane Black has directed. off the top of my head, I can think of a couple of examples of movies of his that are absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, that for me alone, I don't really need to know much about this trailer to know that I'm behind him.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. I even liked Iron Man 3. I know a lot of people don't, yeah. But that even though it probably screws up the universe a little bit, it's fun enough that I don't care. And I'm curious, I mean, if nothing else. I'll be honest, though, other than the first Predator movie, I couldn't get through Predator 2, and maybe it's just because of my age or whatever. But at some point, we'll obviously probably watch that. But I don't know. I'm interested enough, I guess. Shane Black does enough for me.
Predator 2 becomes fun bad when you watch it at Absolutely. This age. Gary Busey's constant cocaine-fueled rampage throughout that film becomes fun. Danny Glover is sweaty all the time, oh, no matter God, where he's
so
at.
Sweaty.
Everyone, for that, it's in Los Angeles in the future, and I think they just dialed up the heat. There's something very campy and cool about it. On top of that, in this new film, Jake Busey is playing the son of Gary Busey's character from Predator 2, so this is really like a nice continuation of all of that.
I think back on that scene of when Danny Glover's in the Predator ship.
Oh, yeah.
I think back about that a lot. Just the him looking around at all the weapons and trying to figure out how to use them. It's a cool scene.
It's a great scene, but that one scene unfortunately spawned the whole idea of Alien versus Predator because of the alien skull on the wall. Stupid prop guys.
That's funny. And then there was another trailer, and I feel like we're going to get back to Predator later on in 88, because there was a lot of things I noticed in the one movie I watched that I want to bring back up, so we'll do that then. But Black Klansman.
Yeah, Black Klansman, which actually premiered at Cannes today and received a six-minute standing ovation from the crowd there. At the Cannes Film Festival, and the first time that's happened for Spike Lee in a long time. This is Spike Lee produced by Jordan Peele, so there's a lot going on there, and this trailer is fantastic, beginning to end amazing. That song, Ball of Confusion, by the Commodores, is such an incredible song, and Temptations, and wow. I mean, that first scene when he's on the phone and he's just doing his white guy voice and talking to David Duke. Wow. That is a hell of a scene just right off the bat. And that's in the trailer. I can't even imagine how great the rest of this movie's going to be. And Adam Driver, come on. This movie's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it was a hell of a trailer. It just looked like a ton of fun. And I don't know. I don't even know how to define it. A little blaxploitation, but not really. I mean, just kind of a little bit of everything, really. I don't know. Very, very fun looking.
It's out of Spike Lee. I expect a little more exposition or something like that out of his films for whatever reason. And this one seemed like more of a Soderbergh film or something. That it's tricking somebody to get them to do something, yet it has a bit of a factual basis in it. And Topher Grace playing David Duke. Okay, I think I can get behind that, because at some point I really disliked Topher Grace, and he's got punch you in the face too, you know, like Franco does. And I think, gosh, Franco as David Duke would have been perfect actually too. But this whole thing sounds like a great idea. Get some real talent behind the camera and then in front of the screen too. Ooh, I mean, in the last line of the trailer, America first, just really, I audibly got upset just hearing that out of the Klansman. So
yeah,
I'm just on board.
Just straight fire in a trailer like that. It's just fantastic.
And I'm sure there's more to the movie than just pure fun, but it's going to be one of those movies that here's your message and, you know, have a good time while you get it.
Here's your message playing to the crowd that already agrees with their message probably too. Can you really imagine anyone actually having their minds changed by anything anymore? I was thinking about that too at the end.
Right. Yeah.
I can't wait to read all the think pieces from people who don't actually see the movie though. That'll be fun. You just know there's already a bunch of people on the right who are already writing angry diatribes about a movie that they're not even going to see.
It'd be nice if people were like, hey, that's an America first. I can get behind that.
Of course. Or they totally don't get the trailer and think, oh, finally, we've recruited one of them. Ah.
Problem is, it starts out with a Spike Lee joint, and they're going to be like, fuck this, and not even get past that.
They don't know what a Spike Lee joint is.
They know who Michael Moore is. They know their names. Spike Lee's that guy who sits at courtside in the 90s at basketball games.
You're right. I'm not giving him enough credit. They know who to hate.
I'm not going to say it. All right. Let's see. What else can we kill time with? Let's just jump into our top five. I mean, we got two movies that, I mean, they're just not allowed to talk about with them.
True.
Good or bad. So we'll go to our top five movies you thought you'd hate but ended up loving, liking, and...
What's your top five? Who's your top five?
I kind of forgot what I had written exactly, and I just put movies that were better than I thought they'd be. But we'll go ahead and start with Jason Mollett, who kind of did a similar thing to me, and I think he confused me because he picked movies that we had brought out on the podcast that ended up being really good that he liked. Short Term 8, The Ballad of Lefty Brown, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Old Boy and Creesha, and I haven't seen Short Term 8, but the rest of them, I am kind of with them. I was ready to turn off Ballad of Lefty Brown, and then all of a sudden that just movie turned around. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I wasn't expecting anything, and was blown away. Old Boy, for obvious reasons. And Creesha, again, a little small indie movie, looks like homework, ends up being this masterpiece of a film.
Oh, yeah.
Uncle Jeff had Wonder, A Perfect World, The Nutty Professor, the Eddie Murphy version, Eraser and Billy Madison. And, you know, you thought you were going to hate him. Wonder, I definitely am with him on. That movie came out of left field for me. And Billy Madison's watchable. I don't have anything.
Eraser's surprising, but I also didn't hate that one. So,
But, and these are movies that you would go into thinking this is going to suck. You know?
Sure, yeah.
So I get behind it. Did we have anybody from Instagram?
I didn't see any, no.
The problem with this is it's hard to Google movies you thought were going to suck, but were really good. Obviously, Mean Girls is a classic. We're going to get to that. I don't love it, but it was way better than it should have been and more fun than I expected it to be. Cannibal Holocaust, that was way better than I thought it was going to be, too. I always, what's that director's name from Eternal Sunshine and Being John Malkovich?
Kaufman. Charlie Kaufman.
Every time I go into his movies, I dread it, and then I ends up being a great experience. So, and those two happen on the show for me. Enemy 2, we hadn't really been familiar with A24 yet. We had seen movies, but not really grabbed on, and thought maybe Sean was overblowing it, and sure enough. and then Mulholland Drive, I did not like David Lynch. I hadn't seen Blue Velvet yet. Lost Highway was terrible, and I just wasn't into his movies, and then that movie took me by surprise. How was that for killing time?
Well, you mentioned David Lynch. Like, Eraserhead is kind of my opposite of this list. Like, I went into Eraserhead thinking this was going to be brilliant, and then I got in about, I don't know, what, about 45, 50 minutes. I'm like, this fucking sucks. Why do people like this?
This is just shit happening.
So that's kind of like the opposite list of this. Things you thought you would like that you ended up hating. But Cannibal Holocaust, I think, is like the number one thing for me, because I really was certain that that movie was going to be just disgusting and just something I would probably want to turn off. And then you get into it further and further, and there's just such a great idea in that movie. Maybe not great cinema in terms of just how it's made, but the idea is so strong, and the way they pull that idea off and the way he sets that movie up throughout, that through line about the, I mean, it's like Network, honestly. I mean, the message is basically what Network was. Just the idea that network television is growing more and more exploitative, and he finally finds their limit. This movie just forces them to take this to the most extreme degree. And I did not see that coming in that movie. I thought it was just going to be exploitative violence, and it was. But at the same time, that exploitative violence had a real smart purpose. Mm-hmm. And that movie, again, is one of the ones that just completely came out of left field for me. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, took me years to come around on that movie, because I thought, as a kid, I just thought, oh, that's just another Halloween, Friday the 13th. None of them are as good as Nightmare on Elm Street. Because Nightmare on Elm Street, that was the one I adopted when I was a kid. And then it took me years to finally actually sit down and watch it and then think about it. And then I thought about it, and then now Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for me, is like up there, like a top five all-time great movie.
Yeah, that would, if it wasn't for the fact that I hadn't seen the movie for, like, ever. I never saw it. And I built it up in my head so much, and I was ready to go see it. And when I finally saw it in my late 20s or whatever, I knew I was going to like it. So that was the only reason I couldn't put it on my list, because upon watching it with the podcast, I liked it even that much more, because you're right, it is one of those type of movies.
Then I have The 7-Year Itch, Marilyn Monroe movie, which, I'd always kind of been down on Marilyn Monroe. I thought she was more of a personality than an actress. And then I watched The 7-Year Itch when we were doing Marilyn Monroe movies, and my God, it was just so funny. That movie is just charm personified. The actor's name is escaping me now, but I mean, he's absolutely brilliant. And the way they use Marilyn Monroe in that movie is absolutely brilliant. Just pitch perfect 50s style comedy, and just so smart, so droll. It's just so simple. It's just a fantastic movie. This guy is married. His wife's out of town for a week. Marilyn Monroe happens to be staying in the apartment across from him. He's a guy who has absolutely no shot with a woman like her, but there's a banter, there's a liveliness to it, and it's just such a fantastic movie. Then also on my list, King Creole, which we did for Elvis Week, and I did not expect any Elvis movie to be any good, but let alone, not only is King Creole good, Elvis is good, and Michael Curtiz's direction of King Creole is incredible. And I shouldn't have been surprised by that, because I love Michael Curtiz. He was the director of Casablanca, and I've appreciated pretty much all the stuff that I've ever seen from him.
But at the same time, he was also a guy who was working in the studio system and churning out movie after movie after movie. And he was a guy who was kind of an anti-auteur. You know, he's a guy who just did a lot of product. And I thought this would probably fall into the product category. But he goes and he makes this incredible musical out of King Creole that is just amazing. And then, of course, Martyrs, which was the one of our Christmas episodes. Martyrs, I thought for sure I was going to hate that movie. And then it turns around, and the violence of that movie, the exploitative violence of that movie, is so well-crafted and so well-used. The tension never lets up. And you can barely take a breath during Martyrs.
Josh?
Well, I don't know if I can be if I can extrapolate that much information from my list, but I agree with you with King Creole. That was a really fantastic movie. I don't know if you ended up watching it that week.
I hated it.
I just found that to be, maybe it's because it didn't suck. And so therefore it could be like part of my list because I was expecting it to be a product. Mine is steeped in stuff that's less than 30 years old. I think that makes a lot of sense because the bulk of my watching is that era. Not a lot of the old films that I've seen surprise me that they're good. Like it's more like, well, yeah, they were better at making movies those days. Or, you know, they were more into the art of it. So nothing I ever expect to suck. I expected to loathe like the old Beauty and the Beast, you know, or the French Donkey movie. and I appropriately loathed them, though. You know, it wasn't hate or love as a result. It didn't go in either direction. For me, number five is The Prince of Egypt, animated film. Yeah, I'm 20 years old at that point, roughly. What am I going to do with an animated film? And it actually, despite being another story about Moses that I already know, is filled with a lot of fun and emotion and really good music and stirring scenes. And Val Kilmer as God is actually good. I mean, it took me by surprise, especially because it wasn't Disney doing it, that it was as good as it was. And it remains for me, although I'm not of the ilk that would prefer that story, I think that it's one of the more spiritual things that I've ever seen. Number four is a movie called In Good Company. I loathe Topher Grace so much. That's why this comes back really nicely. That 70s show was just, I couldn't stand every minute everyone was on screen, except when the redhead was on screen. But then seeing this one was like a chore. This was a trade-off film. If you watch this, you can have like a bucket of popcorn or whatever it was, you know. It was a good trade-off because I watched it. And I was surprised with how solid it was and how much I liked how the story ended. It wasn't too easy. There was a little bit of difficulty in there. I loathe Topher Grace, but then you can kind of relate to him as what is he supposed to do. Scarlett Johansson is really good trying to satisfy both Dennis Quaid, her father, and her boyfriend, and Topher Grace. So, and Paul Weitz is the director of that one. American Pie guy. How could he make a film that would make me feel that way? So I've always remembered that as a task for my significant other to watch, but actually ended up being really great. Serendipity is another one, but I already really like John Cusack, so that doesn't really count. Three for me is Toy Story. At that period of time, 1995, nobody knew what Pixar was, of course. Saying Tom Hanks and Woody and Tim Allen, that means nothing to me because they're doing voices in an animated film. I'm 16 years old. Who cares about this crap anymore, right? And then, of course, it's amazing and reminded me of all of the ways that I loved toys, and I was hooked from that moment on. And from that moment on, I always took animation a little bit more seriously than I thought I would.
Did I ever tell you my Toy Story story?
About Toy Story 3?
No.
But no, go ahead.
I was 15. Because I don't turn till November.
Till later, yeah, yeah.
And we were going to go see 12 Monkeys because it came out the same weekend or right around the same time. And my friend, who's a year younger than me, gives him a ticket, walks right in. I get up to the counter and they're like, let me see your ID. I'm like, oh, I'm 15. That's my dad. He said I can go. They would not let me in.
To 12 Monkeys?
My brother went to Toy Story. And I said, fuck this, and I left. So my friend got stuck there, and instead of going to 12 Monkeys, he snuck into Toy Story with his ticket. I feel bad about it in hindsight, but I don't know.
Man, that's rough.
So when did you finally see Toy Story?
When it came to video.
I have a similar story involving Jurassic Park 3. I had no intention of seeing Jurassic Park 3 by myself. So a friend agreed to go with me so we would, you know, at least be able to share in our miseries. And he didn't show up. And so I'm like, well, I'm not, God damn, what am I supposed to do? I'm over at the Davenport Theater, and I'm not going to go see Jurassic Park 3 by myself. So I ended up sneaking in to see America's Sweethearts. And listen, if anything could possibly be worse than Jurassic Park 3, it's America's Sweethearts.
Why didn't you want to sit by yourself?
It had something, I was feeling like a real big, like, nerd if I went to see a dinosaur movie by myself. I don't know.
What was the first movie you saw by yourself?
Ooh.
America's Sweethearts.
No, oddly enough, I think it was a double feature of Lost in Space and Species 2 in the same day. Now, that's a whole pile of shit right there. I mean, that's 3.5 hours, 4 hours of your life you'll never get back.
The only movie, or the first movie I ever snuck into was Universal Soldier.
Oh, worth sneaking into.
1990-91.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you...
It was part of a four-movie thing we saw that day on, like, one ticket. Me and three other guys, we paid for one movie and then stayed for four.
I've never actually done that. I thought about doing it early on in this podcast, but I actually walked out, paid for Funny People, and went back.
Good man.
I just couldn't do it.
The rest of my list, number two, Pride and Prejudice, the 2004-2005 version, directed by Joe Wright. Again, another task film that ended up being one of my favorite films of all time. It's just incredibly whimsical and does that story a great deal of justice. I've actually gone back and read that book, and it's a film that's very close in intention and execution to the book. My number one is Babe. I blame this all on my mother. No way would I ever see a PG-rated talking animal film when I was 16 years old, and she said, "No, just watch this with me. Trust me." And she used it's produced by the guy that made Mad Max. Does that help? And I guess. And Babe ends up being one of my favorite movies of all time too. Completely out of left field. So that's what this category is for. And that one did the most damage to me is a completely sweet and innocent thing when I was expecting to roll my eyes into the back of my head.
Did you hear us back to Universal Soldier real quick?
Yes, of course.
Stallone had come out and said, this new Rambo movie, he does not fight the Dolph Lundgren character from Universal Soldier in it, because apparently that was what the rumor was going to be. He was going to fight some sort of half-human, half soldier
what?
Type thing.
No, they need to go back and make that happen.
Well, that's it's amazing. Called Universal Soldier. So why? But without Stallone, obviously, it was Van Damme.
Oh my God.
But it was, wow. He actually came out and said he's not doing that.
I had no idea that those universes were considered.
I think he was using it as an example.
After the last Rambo movie, they could be considered in the same universe. They're both that level of dumb. Really, the last three. I mean, other than the first Rambo, really.
Rambo 2 is a ton of fun. You did not watch it with us that time. You took it off. You're relying on your memories.
Do we get to win this time? Fuck you. Fuck you.
But you're saying it out of context. It makes sense in the movie.
You've seen the movie. And fuck him. Oh.
All right.
The first movie takes Vietnam seriously. It deserved to be taken seriously. And then it's like, and then the rest of the 80s is about going back and refighting it. But, you know, a bunch of right wing bullshit movies going back and trying to refight the thing so America can win. Fuck that.
But three, they don't go to Vietnam. And two, he just kind of has a mission. And four, he just blows shit up.
Four, he's making what I thought Cannibal Holocaust was going to be.
Right. All right, we've wasted enough of your time, dear listener. The number one movie this week is still Avengers. But after that is Melissa McCarthy's new movie.
Yeah, Life of the Party. She plays a mom who's going back to school, and it basically takes the premise of that Rodney Dangerfield movie and takes away like having the millions of dollars and, you know, plays off of a number of the similar tropes, I guess. But she gets dumped by her husband, played by Matt Walsh. She decides that then would be a good time to go back to school. She's going to the same school as her daughter. That happens to also have been the school that she was going to when she dropped out to have her child. So there's a symmetry there. But, I mean, this is not a movie that is very smart. It's not a movie that's very well put together. It's poorly directed. Ben Falcone is a nice guy in interviews. And he's Melissa McCarthy's husband. And there's a lot of good things about him. But he's not a very good director. He directs like a television director. And you can't do that in a movie. So his direction is very flat. And his setups are very, you know, pat and overly familiar, and the whole thing is pat and overly familiar, and yet Melissa McCarthy is just that good that I laughed a lot during this movie. There's just right off the bat. I mean, it's a joke that is so obvious she's talking to an Uber driver, and right off the bat, it's a very obvious joke. But when she hits the punchline, I laughed. And that happened again and again in this movie. I was predicting the joke, but she delivered it so well that I still laughed. There's a runner in this movie about her going back to school, and she gets this young guy gets really, really interested in her, and they begin a sexual relationship. And it turns out that she's really great in bed, and this kid just becomes addicted to it and just wants that nonstop. And I laughed just about every time that guy was on screen, and the way they play it, the way it sets up and pays off a couple of times is pretty great. And I'll give Falcone credit for that. I mean, he knows how to set up for a joke. He and Melissa McCarthy wrote the script. So as bad as the direction is in this movie, the jokes are set up to benefit the joke as opposed to actually benefit anything that is really akin to actual, you know, proper filmmaking or storytelling. But the jokes are that good that I actually recommend this movie because I laughed a lot and very loudly. Gillian Jacobs is in this, and Gillian Jacobs from Community and Love on Netflix, which if you haven't seen Love, is a fantastic show on Netflix, produced by Judd Apatow and co-starring Paul Rust. Really fantastic show. But she plays a character who was in a coma for 8 years, and she continuously uses that joke in a way that is maybe the one unexpected thing in the movie. Where this the various different ways she works in her coma girl bit is just I laughed every time. That's how good these people are. I recommend this movie just because it is that funny, and I'm alone on that. Every other critic in the country is savaging this film. And fair enough, you know, most of the time we're looking for proper direction. We're looking for a movie that plays out not so familiarly. But I've lowered my standards in times when I can just have, you know, because there are so few great original premises anymore. If you're going to do something that I recognize too much, at least do it really, really well. And I think Melissa McCarthy does that really, really well. She takes something that is really overly familiar, very predictable, but she is so funny in it that I didn't care as much.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't get the theater this weekend. Despite 3 days off of work, you think that you're going to have the time. Does Melissa McCarthy drop the correct amount of F-bombs here?
That's another surprising thing. PG-13. This is a PG-13 movie, so she's not falling back on that incredible talent she has for the F-word. She finds other ways to be raunchy that are within the bounds, like I said, with the sex thing. But, she's not doing that thing about it. She is the greatest F-word in the business, and she doesn't even without that thing to use, she's still brilliant.
Hmm. That's good.
Yeah, I mean, the movie is not trying to be anything other than her playground, you know, and for that alone, you know, it's made for that audience. It's, you know, it's the defense I always make for Adam Sandler, even though he doesn't even really execute being funny for any of us. But that's, you know, it's that kind of thing, only She can do anything, and she's amazing. I mean, Saturday Night Live, she just pops up at Weekend Update and freaking steals the whole show, and Amy Schumer is the host.
It was inspired, yeah.
So it was just, I don't know. She's just one of those people right now that can, everything she does is, in a way, gold. I don't know if that's...
She's just damn charming. You know, she's just likable and charismatic, and that works enough for me. I mean, I listened to a bunch of other critics just hating this movie, just hating it. I'm hating it more than I hated Overboard, if that tells you, like, that level of hatred that this movie is getting.
Did you hear her on Mark Maron's podcast?
No.
She was talking about the Sean Spicer stuff she did, and she really wanted to, she didn't want to just make fun of the guy. Everything she did, she wanted to be true.
Yeah.
And they wrote the sketch about hiding in the bushes. She was kind of off in her own little world. She didn't know that had happened. And so she's like, this is just mean. We shouldn't do that. And they're like, he really did that. She's like, I'll be right there. But it was, she kind of talks about her and her husband's process. But, and even then, they write it, but then the script is just her playing. You know, they don't follow it by any... at all, so.
Oh, and there's Maya Rudolph is in this movie too. I forgot to mention it. She plays the best friend, and again, you want just riffing. They riff. There's an entire scene that two of them really, where they're just riffing back and forth, where there's absolutely no script and they're just going, and it works because they're that good.
Breaking In, is that what it's called?
Yes, it's not called what was on the poster, something about a bad, don't cross this, I don't know, something about a bad mother, something.
Payback is a mother.
A much better title for this movie than Breaking In, which is such a bland, lame title, but then it fits this bland, lame movie. Gabriel Union is just an everyday mom whose father has some kind of shady business that ends up getting him killed very quickly in the movie. She doesn't know he's been murdered. She thinks it was just a hit-and-run accident, but we know from what we've seen that he's been murdered by a character played by Billy Burke. And that guy is coming with a couple of goons to this house, this vacation home that her father had that she happens to be going to that weekend to try and sell. Now, the smart play here would be you get there, you see that she's there, maybe you don't do it that weekend. Wait till the next weekend after she sold the house, and then maybe you could go in while there's nobody there and, you know, take the money then. But no, we'll go in and make it a mess and kill a bunch of people and be fucking idiots about this because they're trying to steal $4 million that are in a safe that they found out about this guy having. It's really convoluted. Lots of bullshit. Lots of really... poor direction. This is James McTeague. Do you remember James McTeague?
V for Vendetta?
Yes.
Okay.
And that was apparently some kind of... I honestly think the Wachowskis must have backseat directed that movie. It's because that's the only thing to explain it, because this guy's gone on to direct Ninja Assassin, which was absolute utter piece of garbage. The Raven with John Cusack, which made John Cusack look like an amateur. Survivor, his last movie with Mila Jovovich and Pierce Brosnan, was so bad it didn't even get a theatrical release. And, I mean, I just don't know. This guy just is talentless in this movie. Absolutely, utterly talentless. The house, this state-of-the-art house that this been the center of kind of the trailer is talking about, this impenetrable fortress that her children are trapped inside with the bad guys and she's got to figure out a way to get in, is so poorly directed and so poorly established that you don't know where anybody is in relation to the other characters. And, of course, that is the crux of the tension of the movie, is trying to put them in situations where this person's hiding here and this person's coming from this way. But it's so badly directed. Like, Billy Burke's on one level and Gabriel Union's on another, and you don't even realize where they are in relation to each other. And that's supposed to be, I guess, disorienting, but really it's just like, where's the tension? I don't know where anybody is. And... the house is huge, and then rooms just seem to be anywhere the movie wants them to be at any moment. So it's just clumsy. On top of that, we've got a script by the same guy who wrote The Commuter and Rampage. And then he writes this, which I'm glad he's a multi-fucking millionaire now, but he is talentless. This guy is a hack. He also directed or wrote the script for Nonstop, so there you go. I mean, this guy's a hack. Really...
Yeah, he tripled his budget this year, making $18 million, and then Rampage, I don't know how International is doing, but that's only at $90 million.
Internationally, it's done quite well.
Yeah.
This movie sucks. It sucks. It's just poorly directed, poorly written. Gabrielle Union's trying. I mean, she's doing what she can to try and make this work. But the real version of this movie is not a PG-13 action movie. The real version of this is an R-rated revenge movie. That's the real version of this, where you get hardcore and you go real violent with it. And really kind of, that's the movie this should be. I think that's the movie that somebody wanted this to be when it was conceived, and then it was dumbed down for a PG-13 version that they could release over Mother's Day weekend. Ha, 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 because she's a mom.
Payback is a mother.
Oh, happy Mother's Day. Fuck you.
This or actual Mother's Day? Which movie?
This, actually.
Okay.
I hate Mother's Day that much.
Gary Marshall is officially at rock bottom.
I would rather watch Breaking In twice before I ever see 1 minute of Mother's Day again.
He can't make any more movies, though, right?
No, he's dead. He's very, very dead. I keep going to his grave and trying to make sure. Just, you there? Is he there? Make sure he's there.
Are you there, Gary? It's me, Sean.
Then I piss and I go home.
Whoa!
Speaking of that, our classic is Mean Girls.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed
classic.
A subject we talk about a lot last episode, ironically. It was a movie that I believe of Josh. Was Beth the one that suggested
it? Yeah, Beth suggested it. She kept telling me throughout the course of our relationship that I needed to see Mean Girls because she would quote it every once in a while. And I'm like, what? Is that supposed to be from something? And she would say, it's Mean Girls. You haven't seen Mean Girls?
Let's make it the classic. And then we've decided to kind of break up the classic, and we, you know, one of us decides what it is instead of trying to figure it out as a group. And I was like, hey, it's Josh's birthday. Let's talk about Mean Girls on his birthday. It'll be perfect. Happy birthday, by the way.
Yeah. I watched it.
That doesn't sound good.
It's better than it should be. Give it that.
Well, no, please set up the film first before I take it down.
I don't know.
It's actually based off of a nonfiction book. It's about, you know, the relationship between girls in school, and Tina Fey was hired to write the script and wrote a really smart idea of taking this idea of a girl who's come from homeschooling in Africa and putting her into this new jungle of a high school. And heavy-handed metaphor aside, I mean, it's an interesting idea, and I thought it was well played. She's got this sort of perspective of it from a kind of sociology perspective. She's looking at all the individual groups and trying to sort of find her place. And she finds sort of two places in this that are at odds. One is with these kind of outcast kids. And the others in the Plastics, which are a group of the popular girls led by Rachel McAdams as Regina George, which is a character that has become a meme. She's become a popular, like a way of establishing, who somebody is. It's, Regina George is a reference among people of this generation, which I think is pretty emblematic of what this movie is. Lindsay Lohan, I think, this is the one really great performance of her career.
Freaky Friday is okay.
For a little kid. She's very sympathetic, and it's so hard to see her now and not, she's changed the perception even of this character. a little bit, because it becomes a little sad to watch this, and when you think about who she became, and the potential that she had. But you know what else you see in this movie? Rachel McAdams is incredible, and of course goes on to be incredible. Amanda Seyfried is just why somebody needs to put her back in a comedy and just be a real comedy, not Mamma Mia. Give her a real showcase as a comedy, because she is absolutely brilliant. She steals every scene of this movie just with pushing her eyes out a little bit. She steals the scene. That bit about her boobs can tell when it's raining. I never fail to laugh really, really hard at that. And yeah, there's a number of times. There's a number of really funny moments in this that always get me. Stop trying to make fetch happen. I loved that. That line makes me laugh every time.
I loved at the end when she's giving her she becomes prom queen and she's giving her speech, and Tim Meadows just walks in. You don't have to give a speech.
Classically Tina Fey. Right. That's a moment right out of 30 Rock.
Right. Everything. There was enough of those in here that made this kind of a cheesy little, you know, cookie cutter of a movie, at least aware of itself and having that gave me enough fun with it. And then I actually watched with my daughter, who just happens to be a redhead, which made it a little bit more uncomfortable. And then she was asking questions about, because she's old enough to know that Lindsay Lohan has been in jail, and why was she in jail? And she just went to a new school, obviously not from Africa, but just a lot of stuff that made it a different experience this time around. But
how did she end up feeling about it?
Apparently she had seen it, because she started telling me how things would happen. At least I don't know that she'd finished it, though, because as Lindsay Lohan's character starts turning into a plastic, she was getting really uncomfortable with it, not liking it, and then obviously towards the end was more on board with it. But I don't know. Josh, tear it apart.
No, not necessarily. I'm going to admit to the amount of times I laughed out loud to exceed half a dozen, at least. I mean, the not don't make fetch happen. the can tell when it's raining thing. Amanda Seyfried's whole performance, for that matter, is the best part of this movie to me, because she takes the prototypical dits to a level that I hadn't seen before. There's nothing typical about her performance. She's an airhead, but like almost aware that she's an airhead, and she won't give up on trying to hit on her cousin from across the room. That's some good stuff right there.
That is a funny one.
And within the first 10 to 15 minutes, I found that I had lulled four times. Okay, and I thought that this was going in a positive direction. But I also noticed that this was a nonfiction book beforehand, and that Tina Fey had written a screenplay. I had thought that this was Tina Fey's original creation this entire time, and seeing that lessened it only slightly for me. I had expected this something that was so ingrained into popular culture that literally came from Tina Fey's brain, all of it, that it was maybe that important. The fact that it's nonfiction, which I wasn't aware of, I just saw the novel credit there, that does help a little bit. That just means that she's taking something there combined with perhaps her own experience and what culture is telling her to make a screenplay out of it. And her performance, for that matter, is a good performance as well. I enjoyed that a lot. There's a part of this, though, that's really grounded in a nice message along with the comedy. And then they decide to do stupid shit. And that's when I was starting to check out. Why would you hit by a bus? Really? Like, that's farce. It stretches too far into farce for me to take it all that seriously as a cultural landmark. Consistency of direction is the problem here, okay? If somebody else perhaps I can't remember the dude's name. Okay. If somebody else maybe had taken the reins on this and made it more in the line of something like John Hughes would have done, I'm not saying that John Hughes is the be-all, end-all for young person films, but at least I can say about his films, consistency, consistency, consistency. Ferris Bueller is consistently breaking the fourth wall, okay? You know, at least we understand where he's going. He's a Bugs Bunny character throughout the whole film. There's nothing that's a break on that. With Mean Girls, I felt that Lindsay Lohan was in one movie at one time, in another movie at another time, and then at the end, it's more of like a, let's get this all rounded up together and have your typical high school moments, okay? And the message part of the film where they're getting everyone together in a gym, all of the girls as part of this high school to kind of repair the damage that has been done, that was so much less effective than what I thought it would be. There's a real message that needs to happen there, and this film had the ability to do that, and it doesn't really. It just almost makes the plastics something to be, as opposed to something that you want to avoid. Because it's funny and whatnot, then it's like, oh, well, I guess I'm a plastic now. No, that you don't want that. They're villains. Come on. And it kind of popularizes that idea of villainhood to me. Maybe I'm wrong on this. Now, at the end of the film, I was talking about, you know, the problem with this is the message, is that it's not really harnessing its ability to send out that kind of message about girls attacking each other, okay? It's just something trope that Tina Fey says in the gym. And I was asked, well, then what would you say would be a good message for them? You can say The Breakfast Club? I'm like, well, yes. Because at least with The Breakfast Club, you've got all of them sitting amongst each other, peers that don't interact all the time, saying things about their life that are really serious, okay? And this is real life crap here that teens watching The Breakfast Club could say, okay, yes, I know that kind of person in my school. I imagine that perhaps the loner sitting at the back of the class actually has something to say eventually. That's something you can take away from that. And this one had the ability to do that, and I'm almost more disappointed that it didn't follow through on, like, hey, really, you shouldn't be dicks to your fellow classmates, you know? Lift them up instead of taking them down. Maybe I'm asking too much from it, but I thought that it would be both comedic and actually matter. And it doesn't matter. It's just comedic sometimes. And see, that's the part that I'm disappointed in.
See, I didn't get that message out of that scene. Because, I mean, what happens in that scene is that the two remaining plastics, I mean, obviously Katie is still at a point in the movie where she's trying to come to terms with what she's done. And she's feeling guilty, but at the same time, too scared to admit her guilt. And that's kind of the crux of that scene, is her kind of ducking her way, trying to duck her way out of that. Then the other two, basically one falls on top of the other in a relatively funny pratfall. And Regina is not embraced by anybody. She's called out for her shit, for what she does in that scene. Everybody raises their hand. Have you been hurt by Regina George? You know,
sure.
So she's not. Made into a martyr or anything, or celebrated.
Sure, sure.
The only thing that doesn't happen is that which maybe it should have culminated there instead of at the dance. I think maybe that would have been a more satisfying ending if she comes to terms with it right then and there. But there needed to be a little bit more on the end, a couple other plots that needed to be resolved. That scene was more, I thought, about Lizzie Kaplan's character forcing everything to come to a head in a much different way, and I thought that to me was effective.
I forgot about Lizzie Kaplan for just a moment. Seeing her in the film was a definite plus. I'm a big Lizzie Kaplan fan, and seeing her play the type of character that she did, I'm like, oh, she should be playing that type of character in like everything she's in, because she's so great at being sardonic like that. What I mean is, it was almost a little too easy for Regina George to be at the same school and kind of nod from across the room to people, ha, we went through some shit together, didn't we? Now, she should have had more of a comeuppance than an easy, like,
well, she got hit by a bus. Well,
here's, to me, that's a little too easy. It's much harder to actually look within yourself, and it doesn't seem that the film was actually interested in having her look within herself, other than, I got hit by a bus, I had to change. You know, it's a little lame. Like I said, it's not that it's bad. It's just, I wish it was more, and that is the letdown. Comedy, not message.
That was the same problem I had with The Breakfast Club, though. I mean, all of a sudden they're doing the Scooby-Doo chase down the hallway, which is just as much of a, you know, twist, you know, out of left field thing as the bus. It doesn't really make sense in the sense of the movie, but, and it just, and I watched that kind of for the first time as an adult, and I thought the message there was just too coincidental, and, oh, we just happened to have one of every click in the, you know, and
Sure, you have a point with that. I was thinking that you almost need to represent all of them to have a movie taken seriously, because at right. some point, someone in the high school that isn't represented in that film is going to say, wait a minute, there's us too. I can't relate to this movie. They got everyone in there. Yes, it's a coincidence plot-wise, but... Yeah,
and on top of that, it's a stereotype of all of them too. It's not like a real person, but,
I mean, they're saying real things. That's what I bought from it.
But again,
this isn't a movie podcast about the Breakfast Club.
We're
but
both
I did mean to bring
different. the same thing.
You know, it's a better version of both of these movies that doesn't get talked about enough. Is Easy A with Emma Stone, which takes a lot of these similar ideas and does them far better. Even though it doesn't necessarily have that whole click thing to it, it does have a much better message. It has equally as good laughs as either of those two movies. A far better lead performance from Emma Stone than is in any performance in either of those two movies. As much as I love The Breakfast Club, and the final message of that film that she puts forward in the final moments of that movie is just it's perfect. She nails it, and it's a really one of the most underrated and among the absolute best high school movies ever made.
That's one I haven't seen,
and yeah, I mean that's. Perfect example, because it's also not nearly as popular as either one of these movies. and I don't know. I guess I just like the way they just kind of they knew it was going to start to get cheesy, and I would just throw the stupid shit in here, like the bus and Tim Meadows popping in saying dumb things that we're all thinking.
The little bit that he's got where he's constantly wearing a cast. Come on, dude! You don't need that.
My carpal tunnel came back. I got divorced. I win.
but probably not a classic, but just an excuse for Josh to watch Mean Girls.
It was not the absolute hardship that it was made out to be for me. So you lose. I win.
number 18 in 1988. Squeezed and pulled and hurt my neck in 1988.
Squeezed and pulled and hurt your neck in
1988.
Four films. I've seen one of these, and the three others, I half-assed looked for them. They barely made any money, so it's kind of like almost a week to skip, in a way, for me. We'll start with Shakedown. No, that was last week. Bulletproof with Gary Busey. And just reading the synopsis of this, dangerous terrorists getting a hold of a tank from the army and all. No.
I've not seen this movie, but Allison Pregler, Obscurus Lupa Movie Nights on YouTube, you got to see the review of this. It is absolutely hysterical. This movie is completely batshit. For some reason, Gary Busey early in the movie is having a showdown with some bad guys, and he's standing on. He's like they're in this like warehouse, and he's up in the rafters, and he's gonna drop down on them, and he just calls one of them a butthorn. Butthorn? What the fuck are you talking about?
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
And then for some reason, he's an LA cop, and suddenly I think this is another one where they went back and fought Vietnam again. Like, I think that's where this one goes, I believe. Which is so stupid.
Every time I tried to find this movie, the Damon Wayans, Adam Sandler movie would come up. I'm like, no, not that Bulletproof. Come on.
But yeah, Movie Nights on YouTube, Bulletproof with Gary Busey. You got to watch it.
I can't imagine that the movie is any better than that.
Far better than the movie.
Okay. Also, Illegally Yours, Rob Lowe, Colleen Camp, Peter Bogdanovich, called in for jury duty. A man finds his first crush and only real but unrequited love on trial for murder. Aw. All right.
Rob Lowe would just do about anything in the 80s, wouldn't he?
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
In the 80s. He still knows everything.
Now all he does is California commercials.
That's funny. The Wrong Guys, and for some reason 1988 kept wanting to make comedians that weren't really funny famous and continue to make money off of them. Louis Anderson, Richard Lewis are the headliners in this, and John Goodman's in it too. But I remember watching Richard Lewis stand up, and the bit got old quick. And I was like 10, 11 years old when I first saw Richard Lewis stuff, and I still didn't think it was all that funny. after the first 10 or 15 minutes because he's so self-deprecating to the point where is there depth to this? No, it's just him being self-deprecating. And Louis Anderson was never funny to me, not for a single moment. And okay, it's easy comedy, right? Just like Richard Lewis could be easy comedy for people, but those two in a movie together, no.
But you should see his work now on Baskets with Zach Galifianakis on FX.
Louis Anderson?
Yes. Louis Anderson. He's
like winning awards for it.
Yeah, he's Emmy winner for this. Like, that's how good he is. And he plays Zach Galifianakis' mother.
Okay.
Yes, it's weird, but it works.
I've always liked Louis Anderson. I like Richard Lewis too, so I don't know.
Do you ever watch his cartoon?
Yes.
Little Louis.
This
Little
cartoon.
All right. Well, gee whiz, I'm really in the minority on this one.
I hated Bobby's World, but
And then Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood. We just got done talking about Friday the 13th. I'm fresh out of
I can't even remember if I had this on my list or not, did I?
No, we stopped at 5, I think.
Okay.
This is the one with Bernie in it from Weekend at Bernie's. Terry Reiser's the lead.
At least
he's listed first.
I don't know if he's the lead. The lead's a girl. Kane Hodder's
Jason.
Oh,
is this the
Carrie.
The Carrie one, yeah, okay. Yeah, she's like got powers, and she uses them to call forth her dead father and drag Jason back into the lake.
Okay, that's Jennifer Banco. Terry Kaiser's the guy I'm thinking of, not Terry Reiser. So Terry Kaiser's Bernie.
This movie was not aware that it was bad, which I found fascinating because I think after this they start to be like from Takes Manhattan or Jason whatever Manhattan on, they knew they were making bad movies. This one was. They weren't aware of it. They killed people who weren't having sex or doing drugs, which didn't make a whole lot of sense.
No. That's an aspect of this you have to have.
At one point, one of the characters says, "I'll be back," like that. This is before Terminator 2. Or is that in Terminator?
Well, he says it in Terminator.
Oh, that must be what it's from, then.
Yeah.
So it was just, I don't know, it was just weird.
I mean, this one is so, like, divorced from reality. You wonder at times if this was somehow not a Jason movie, and they decided, well, hey, you know, we got the script laying around. Why don't we throw Jason in it?
I will. At the same time I was watching this, my wife was watching The Snowman. And I'm sitting there going, this is way better than The Snowman.
It really is.
by like, a lot. Because in a lot of ways, it's like what Rocky IV was, what Rambo II is. It's trying. It thinks it's good, but it ends up kind of being fun later on, kind of intentionally, but kind of it's not fun bad, but it's just kind of like, this is a silly little horror movie. It's way more fun than it should be. And I don't know. I'm not going to remember it too much longer, but it was a decent experience, largely due to remembering The Snowman while I watched it, which helped.
You get to see one of Jason's many weird faces.
Yeah.
She makes the mask small to a point where it, like, explodes off his head. Mm-hmm. Or she's making his head big. I can't remember exactly.
Because she has telekinetic powers?
Yeah, she drops a house on him
at one point. She's basically Carrie.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's not as good as any of that. But I was just, you know, when you start comparing it to other movies, it's like, oh, you know, when they stopped trying and just had fun, that was okay. But they were, like, trying to make a good, fun action movie here, horror movie, and they didn't succeed, per se. But it ended up, you know, over time, I think time's been kind of good to this one.
It's kind of fun bad.
But, yeah.
That's it for 88 this week.
Anything to look forward to?
Well, next week is Willow, which we've already discussed as undisputed classic / what have you.
Oh, no.
This week, there is news, rumors circulating that they are going to make a Willow sequel. That's weird, right? Because
that is weird.
That one only made like $60 million back then, and nobody knows what Willow is now. I mean, I'm wondering if they're trying to ramp up a 30th anniversary thing that I'm just not aware of or not, but
maybe they're trying to ride the Ron Howard wave because they're going to have a hit in Solo and he's going to be a big name director again, and
If he does it, that would really surprise me.
I mean, Willow was kind of my Princess Bride, my Labyrinth. Those movies didn't exist to me. I didn't even know what they were. This was the movie that I detached. You'll be right. No one else did. So it was like, okay, I'm kind of alone here.
I saw Willow when it came out, and I have not seen it since, I don't think.
I've seen it a bunch.
Be a good time to revisit.
But we do have a classic in place.
Oh, boy.
Yes! That's right!
Oh, no.
Ha-ha! Hopefully,
Josh's real birthday present.
Hopefully we can finish it before the episode starts next week. It's long. But I went and bought some DVD or Blu-ray of all three movies that...
You know, you could just borrow them from me.
Yeah,
again, when I have
you're gonna bring over like that unrated 9-hour director's cut version.
It is the extended version, right. I agree.
It is Lord of the Rings, the very first one.
The Fellowship
of the Ring, yeah. The title, almost as long as the movie. You know what you should do, Bob? You want to really have some fun with this? Because you should, while you're watching it, you should bring down a treadmill and put that in front of your TV and try and walk the movie.
Try really hard to take it seriously. I mean, the movie did us all a favor by cutting out a lot of the
what
initial 150.
No, go ahead, finish.
I understand what you mean. But the first 100-150 pages, there's a lot of stupid exposition. There's a whole character in scene that they cut out of the series completely of a dude that talks to trees and whatnot.
Is
it's
that,
just so lame.
Tom Bombadil.
I hated that so much. And my son and I were reading it together starting in 2012. And just as of earlier this year,
we were halfway through
the first book.
Yes.
You were seriously right, because there's so much to discuss,
right.
and at some point I was trying to do all of the voices too, but now he's older, and so I shouldn't be doing that kind of thing.
But I still do.
Just because I still like to do Gandalf, yeah, but he took it on his own, and he's finished the first book, and he's well into the Two Towers, so he's going to watch that with me this week, and I'm very excited to bring his reaction to the show. That'll probably reignite the series for me. The Hobbit really left something of a stain in my mouth. Stain in my memory. Not in my mouth. Why would I say that? Jeez. Did I sustain a brain injury? Yeah, maybe.
Can I just listen to like Led Zeppelin songs?
Yes, you can. Listen to Ramble On, but
for 3 hours.
put on like Zeppelin 3 and see if it matches up with the movie.
Oh, see, that would be fun. That would be seriously cool. But Ramble On is on 4, isn't it?
2.
It's on 2. Okay.
There are a wonderful series of video essays by a woman named Lindsay Ellis on YouTube that would... You could probably watch that and not watch the movie, actually.
Well, I bought the movies. It's just... And I've seen The Fellowship of the Ring, and it's like it's not a bad movie. It's just long, and there's a lot of walking. The Two Towers, I feel like I got a little... I can't remember if I got better or worse.
I hated The Two Towers.
I think The Two Towers has...
It's more of an action movie? Or not
the Return
really.
Of the King is the emotional coda, of course, but the second one is definitely more of an action film. Everyone's gathering and whatnot, and the Battle of Helm's Deep is one of the most impressive battles I've ever seen on screen, with all of the explosions and the fact that it's nighttime and raining, and it's you can still see what's going on, which is a really hard thing to do when you're filming in the dark. In the fun scenes between Legolas, and I know that you don't like those, but I mean between Gimli and Legolas. Oh, it's just a hell of a lot of fun.
I've never quite... And maybe this is just a testament to maybe that they were enjoying it so much, maybe. But the crowd I was with during Two Towers, when they get to that ending and you see the two characters, they're standing on a mountaintop,
yes,
looking, and there's all this space to go yet. And then it cuts to Peter Jackson's credit, and people are like, what the f-? They were so mad. I don't know if they were just so into it at that point, and then they suddenly realized, oh, fuck, I got another year now.
Or if they were just like...
On them because they put out three different posters before Lord of the Rings Fellowship came out explaining what was going to happen. And the first trailer said, in 2001, you get this. In 2002, you get this. That's on them. I'm not concerned.
And there's three books, correct?
Yes.
So you knew there was another one.
Yeah, I think people often saw Lord of the Rings, though, as one book with all three volumes in it. It had been some time since all three volumes had been sold separately.
All three volumes were long as shit, too, though.
Yeah, book length.
On the other end of that, there is a sort of cynical business side to having made these as three movies, because there was an initial idea to possibly do them as two, and there was a business decision that was eventually made to make them three.
I think that there was plenty of material to make three all three movies were nominated for Best Picture. Whatever you want to say about that, like, they were commercially very, very successful, and a lot of people love them.
And they came out with, like, really long extended director cuts as well. Mm-hmm. So,
which you're going to watch this week.
Yeah, no.
I mean, I was concerned about the version that you bought, but then I looked closer. I'm like, nah, he's all right.
That's just the theatrical version, isn't it? Where did they like combine like The Godfather, where they put them all together, like one long running three-way movie?
Only in my house.
That's Josh's three-way for you. Bookending the podcast. But this is afterwards, so this is like the epilogue or whatever. Patreon. Or before we get that, Deadpool 2 comes out next week, and I was thinking it'd be kind of cool to see Deadpool in the Lord of the Rings movies. Just like edit him in, and when you get to the end of the Two Towers, looks like we got another movie or something like that. I don't know. Book Club and Show Dogs.
Oh man, that's going to be brutal.
Deadpool 2 will be fun, though.
Oh, no, but Deadpool 2 should be fine. I'm hearing really great things about that. Book Club and Show Dogs especially. Show Dogs looks like my nightmares come to life, because this is like the director of Scooby-Doo directing Raja Gosnell directing a talking dog movie. Like, just, I mean, if you threw in Adam Sandler, you just have a fucking pure-ass nightmare right there.
Book Club looks gentle and pleasant.
Hey, is Helen Mirren in it?
Old ladies reading 50 Shades of Gray.
Oh, yeah. I remember that trailer.
A Diane Keaton.
Yeah.
No, Sean's favorite. And Diane Keaton hasn't made a good movie in 25 years, so rock on.
And then our top five is iconic movie props. So things that stick out, you know, like Buddy Christ or something like that.
Lightsaber.
Some sort of ring of some sort that may have inspired the list.
The ring on a TV that a girl walks out of.
Have you told Beth yet that in your wedding vows, this is the one ring to rule them all?
Well, that's why it's on this ring. That's why it's on this engagement ring.
So, yes,
he has. The best $12 engagement ring ever.
That's awesome. But yeah, Patreon, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. If you want to have a credit on the show, we have our Key Grips, Jason Bryant, and Charlie Messing. Our character actors, Josh and Christina.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Our special effect level, Corey.
May the force be with you.
Our associate producer, Jason from New Mexico.
Everybody has to eat shaving cream once in a while.
And our movie stars, Dave Seavers and Uncle Jeff.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
If you want to be a Patreon supporter, ihatecritics.net/Patreon. Get a credit on the show, select merch, yada, yada, yada. We'll make some more eventually. And, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Critics Pod. And then go to Apple Podcasts, subscribe to the show, and rate and review the show. so we can read your review on the air and help us move up the movie charts. We managed to go an hour 20.
Nice.
Do we do Flick Chart or just call it a day?
Give it 5 minutes if you like, at least.
Yeah.
All right. Here's the song, which I don't even know why we put that between this and Flick Chart, but anyway, here it is.
That ought to do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
And we're the three best friends that anybody could have. We're the three best friends that anyone could have. We're the three best friends that anyone can have. And we'll never, ever, 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 ever leave each other. We're the best three friends that anybody could have. I mean the three best friends that anybody could have. The friends, the three best friends.
All right. As good as it gets, a pretty woman.
As good as it gets, yeah. Sorry, I forgot who Pretty Woman was for a second. I fucking hate that movie.
As good as it gets. Sean's going to pee on copies of Pretty Woman, too.
Just brings the entire catalog to his grave. And
then I set them on fire.
He says, piss is flammable.
Okay, fine, I'm Ghost Rider.
All right.
Apollo 13 or Cool Runnings?
Apollo 13.
Yeah. You say yeah? Or are you thinking?
Apollo 13, I guess.
No, I'll just say Cool Runnings for fun. Ooh. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
God. Eternal Sunshine.
You don't happen to have my top 50 available to you off the top of your head? Both of the... Well, no. Crouching Tiger is the one in the top 50, so that's what it is, barely.
It's probably Eternal Sunshine, but I'm probably recency bias. A Nightmare on Elm Street or Desperado?
A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Agreed. Believe it or not.
I agree, I like too, Desperado. But I do like Desperado. Juno, or As Good As It Gets.
Juno.
The Jack Nicholson select lines in that film or the entirety of Juno. It would be Juno, but there's some good stuff out of Jack in that one.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I kind of feel like I need to get that back in my head because I just feel like I'm not appreciating it like I should because I'll take Juno as well. But I did like the movie at the time a lot. Big Fish or A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Wow, that's brutal. That is a brutal choice. You.
But we're not going to say our answer until you choose.
Which one do I hate less? Yes. Big Fish.
I'll never forget League of Extraordinary Gentlemen calling itself LXG. I never understood that. Big Fish is my clear answer.
Oh, yeah, me too. Did you ever hear the why Sean Connery took the movie?
I don't think so, no.
I can't remember what I'm going to screw it up. There was another comic movie that he turned down. He thought it sounded stupid. And then it ended up being huge. Maybe it was X-Men or something like that. I don't know. And then this came up and he's like, oh, comic movie. I got to do it. Because it's a guaranteed success. But he didn't know what it was. And they, I don't know, pissed Alan Moore off. Which is really hard to do.
Most cantankerous bastard in the world.
Phone Booth or Munich?
Ooh, that's a good one. Those are two really fun movies. Like, Phone Booth is like really clever. But Munich, I think, is a better made movie. So I'll go Munich.
Myself as well.
I'll go Phone Booth. Mission Impossible 3 or Hudson Hawk?
Mission Impossible 3.
Agreed.
Hudson Hawk. Nostalgia purposes. Interview with the Vampire, Talladega Nights.
I'm so tired of Talladega Nights. I've always kind of liked Interview with the Vampire a little bit. I don't know. Talladega Nights barely, I guess.
Interview barely.
I really like Talladega Nights, so I'll just take that one. The Day After Tomorrow or A Beautiful Mind.
A Beautiful Mind.
Agreed.
Such a terrible title.
Million Dollar Baby or Chasing Amy?
Chasing Amy.
Chasing Amy.
Agreed. Red Dragon or The Wrestler?
The Wrestler.
Someday, Josh.
Sorry. The Wrestler would clearly win. I haven't seen it.
It's The Wrestler for me. The Terminator or Hitch?
The Terminator.
Terminator.
Yeah.
I like Hitch, though. It's all right.
10 Things I Hate About You or Knocked Up?
Knocked Up.
10 Things I Hate About You?
Knocked Up. Insomnia or The Thing, 1982?
Insomnia is a really great movie that not enough people have seen.
The Thing is a really great movie that not enough people have seen.
They both are, but I mean, for a lot of reasons, it's The Thing. But Insomnia is definitely underrated. Reservoir Dogs or Burn After Reading?
Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
But again, Burn After Reading, highly underrated.
Serenity or Requiem for a Dream?
Ooh, that's a good one, because those are two very different good movies. I guess because Requiem is so hard to watch, I would have to go Serenity, because I could watch Serenity 1,000 times.
My argument, exactly.
Requiem. someone needs to say something funny. Cops and, Cops and Robbersons or The Game?
The Game.
The Game!
True Lies or Road to Perdition?
Road to Perdition.
Yeah, Road to Perdition. I never understood True Lies' whole like romantic angle thing. If they would just tell each other shit, that movie has nowhere to go.
Yeah, that stupid, you know, stripper scene?
Yeah.
What is that?
So it's.
I do remember loving it as a kid and then hating it as an adult. It's one of those movies that definitely, like, how did I like? Like, I thought Tom Arnold was clever and funny, and then I watched it like of age, and I was like, "What the hell's wrong with
me?" Oh God! I mean, that is one of the worst Bill Paxton performances too. That he is awful in that movie.
But Jamie Lee Curtis knocked it out of the park, and that's about it. What Women Want or Braveheart?
Braveheart.
Braveheart.
Good night.